alcoholic.
Hello.
All right, so we will go ahead and get going with our next speaker. So I heard Peter speak a long time ago. I don't remember. But in varying times throughout my sobriety, I find myself pulling up his speaker tapes and listening. This man is like a vision of God to me, and I hear so much out of what he has to share. So I'm really excited for him to be here this weekend. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule. So please help me welcome Peter.
Hell yeah.
My name is Peter. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank the group for having me back here to the frozen tundra. I appreciate it. I've been to Nebraska probably 8 times, and only once it's been warm. So God has a sense of humor. But I'm grateful all of you guys have been here, and thank you for the first speaker. That was fabulous. Thank you so much for feeding me for an hour. Thank you. June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol. I'm very grateful to be a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very grateful on most days to be open to many things and attached to very little, to live in spirit, with inspiration, to be inspired, to live what our book, big book, talks about, the world of the spirit. And what I learned early on is there's two things that are going to manage my life, and only two things. It's either going to be my mind, which doesn't work, or God. And based on my actions, you can usually see when it's the mind, or you can see when it's God. And I learned the hard way. Most of my lessons, most of my epiphanies have been through, you know, forging things out on an anvil and lots of pain. And through pain, we learn humility. But something happens to someone like me in Alcoholics Anonymous where I start to get the aha moment that the fail system, the mind, doesn't work, and God could and would if he was sought. I see things through the mind, I speak through the mind, I act through the mind. All my perceptions are as I am, not as things really are. And I'm wondering how come I can't get connected, why I'm having trouble in personal relationships, why I'm full of fear, why all these things are going on, and that is sober. And what I learned early on, the hard way, was being separated from alcohol, removing the symptom, doesn't make me much better. In fact, for me, it makes me much more dangerous. When I'm drinking, I'm really predictable. I drink, I get drunk, I cry, I borrow money off you, then I pass out. It's very easy to follow me around. It's when I'm not drinking on the pursuit of a drink to get money, I'm very unpredictable. And what's really, really frightening to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and still have those manifestations of self showing up while I'm sober. And so I'm getting 90 days, I'm getting 6 months, I'm getting 1 year, and we can tend to look at this journey in Alcoholics Anonymous as a linear one rather than a transformational one, because God's not interested in time. He's given it to me in the first place, but what am I doing about it? If spirituality doesn't touch every single area of my life, it touches none of my life, and that's for me, because my alcoholism touched every single area of my life. And somehow I come into Alcoholics Anonymous and I think all I have to do is not drink and I'm a winner, and the jury is still out on that one, because I can be an AA angel and a house devil. You know, I can be Moses in here for an hour, but if you see me in a parking lot, I'm talking to Susie with 13 days back, wondering what she's doing later on. But when I come in here, I'll do a great 11 step for you, and I'll give advice, because I don't use it, so I'll give it to you. So June 23rd, 1988 was my separation from alcohol. And I will tell you on the front end here that 4 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I meant it from my heart, I would tell you I surrendered on June 23rd, 1988. And I would tell you how hard I've worked at my steps, how hard I've worked to be a member of Good Standing of Alcoholics Anonymous, how hard I've been working on my inventory and my fourth step, etc. And I meant that from the soul. But the truth is true until we find out a new truth. And none of that was true. It was based on my perceptions and conceptions at the time. So my mind creates filters which I see my experiences through. And sometimes those filters aren't working too good. I was surrendered on June 23rd, 1988 because I didn't have the ability to come to those kind of terms, that kind of aha moment to say, I surrender, which is all self-reliance. If I tell you I surrender, that's totally self-reliant. And our book talks of self-reliance doesn't work. I was surrendered on June 23rd, 1988. I was given endurance. I was given what I like to call my first encounter with God, and that was a gift of desperation. I was given that, which brought me to a state of reasonableness, which our big book talks about. When someone is reasonable, you can negotiate with them, yeah? When they're not reasonable, you can't talk to them. You were sharing about that earlier, in and out. You weren't listening. But something happens, alcohol beats us into a state of reasonableness, and suddenly we're listening. I got room service in this place. I love it. It's great. And on June 23rd, 1990, I'm laying in an abandoned building where I was living for quite some time. I was homeless for a while. In an area called Manhattan, called the Lower East Side, or Alphabet City. And at the time, it was a very, very sordid spot. And junkies and winos ran through that, and people who couldn't afford to move out were stuck there. But I was the type running through those neighborhoods, and I was up to no good all the time. And I took up residency in the back of an abandoned building. And I kind of liked this abandoned building because the cops rarely rolled through it unless it was a 911. I was tucked away in the back, and no one really cared. And I felt safe in this madness. I felt safe. And that's the thing about trapdoors having trapdoors. I think of the first time I drank, I'm in an abandoned building, and I'm saying, well, as long as I don't get arrested, an abandoned building's okay. On my first drunk, if you told me I was going to live in an abandoned building, I would probably get a lunacy commission for you because I wasn't going to wind up there. But there I was. So I was homeless for quite some time, and I didn't see God coming on June 23rd, 1988. In fact, I didn't even know it was June 23rd, 1988 until I got into treatment and they do something called an assessment and they said to me, you should remember this date. It's going to be a sober date. And I was like, I don't really care. I'm drinking as soon as I get out of here because that wasn't the plan. Yeah, as desperate as I was. See, I couldn't see God coming back then. He was about to split me wide open, and only in a breaking open of us can God's light shine through. It's not comfortable. Trust me, guys, if you're looking to really get right with God and get traction with God and commune with God and have this transformation, a spiritual experience to bring about this personality change and really feel oneness with God, you're not going to be comfortable for a while. If you're seeking comfort, just stay delusional and you'll be fine. Because the thing about experiencing God, he's going to turn everything upside down and inside out. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions on page 27, which own me, have to be cast aside. And God will take out a sledgehammer to do that. My job now is to know God, love God, serve God in this life, to be with him in the next. And how long do I have to wait for this God until he's done molding me into what he created in the first place? Yeah. So here I was in June of 88, laying in the back of this abandoned building, and I couldn't see my life about to change. I couldn't see God coming the way I cannot see God coming now. You know, I offer a prayer, whether it's in desperation or looking for an answer. I'm just afraid about something. I'm perplexed by something, and I can't see the answer coming. And it'll come quickly and slowly, but it'll come. And sometimes it'll be speaking to a newcomer one day back, and aha, I got the answer. Or maybe I go to a meeting that I don't attend, and the speaker's up there, and I get the answer. But they're always there. God's always talking to me. God's always talking to us. I know some old timers I've run into and says, well, if you're hearing God's voice, you probably need to be on medication. And I said to him, well, who else is God going to talk to but us? And not only us, but people out there. I just need to be awake enough to hear that voice and not the voice in the head. I haven't thought about a drink in a long, long time. But what I learned is doesn't mean the drink isn't thinking about me every single day. My alcoholism is obsessed with me. I'm its number one priority. And I get to do this a lot. And it's a great way to pull the rug on me by getting attached to this stuff. By getting attached to traveling. Thinking I don't have to do inventory because I spoke in Nebraska this week and so I could take a couple of days off. I don't need to work with the newcomer. Because alcoholism is always thinking about me. But here I was on June 23rd, 1988. I'm laying this abandoned building and it was incredible. When our book talks about the age of miracles is still with us, we will experience that. The mind will look to cast it aside, try to interpret it, and make logic out of something that is not logical, and that's called God. God doesn't operate on this plane, yeah? God operates on a plane that my mind cannot comprehend. If my mind can comprehend it, then it's not God. I look at like life like a spreadsheet. 1 + 1 = 2. Got it. God doesn't work that way. But it can be experienced. And what we do in AA is we tell stories. Yeah, we tell stories. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Even if we're doing a step, we might tell a story in a step to illustrate the journey. And they're all God's stories. And most of it doesn't make sense. Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned, for me, and I speak for me, doesn't make sense. One drunk working with another? This is dangerous. God could have gave this message, this solution, to some of the greatest minds and greatest religious leaders in the world. And he takes two drunks and says, here's the answer. Go work with others. It doesn't make sense. How do folks like us who come in with track records that are brutal, that are awful, shame, guilt, embarrassment, things we don't want anyone to see, and we come in here and we use that to help someone else? This is the only place on the planet that I know of that I can tell you about the most terrible, god-awful, nasty things I've done, and you say, here's my number, give me a call. I mean, you know, that's on me. So I'm laying in this hallway, and up until then, and when I was growing up, my mom, January 23rd, 1974, she took her life. That was just, I think, yesterday. And my world turned upside down, and I despised God. I hated God after that happened. And if you were a man who talked about godly things, spiritual things, things pertaining to religion, I thought you were weak and cowardly because God, religion, spirituality is for women and children. It's not for men. Men have to be like John Wayne and just go out there and grab life and go do it. And church and services, that's for women and children. And people, I remember when I was homeless and walking through the streets, the Bible beaters would come by and say, Jesus loves you and you got to read the scripture. And I was brutal with them, what I would tell them. No problem with the carpenter, but this message is weak and you're a coward because you're a man following this. And God knew all of this. I'm laying in the back of this abandoned building, and what I was going through at the time was like, I was going through withdrawal all the time. I didn't have the luxury of laying off the sauce for a few days and then needing to go drink again. If I laid off for a short time, I was vibrating and shaking and going through withdrawal, so I needed a drink desperately. And I was also, I used to love to eat pills back then. For the little dope fiends in here, I have a whole history of narcotics in the past. Raise his hand, I got his attention. Okay. Now it's a good meeting. Okay. But so I used to drink and eat pills, and I'm in the back of this abandoned building, and I'm vibrating, and I'm lying on the floor, and I go to get up to have to hustle up money on the street. That's what I do, panhandle and such, and anything I could really do to get a couple of bucks to get to the liquor store, get a pint of whiskey. And on this particular day, which happened to be June 23rd, I got up off the floor, and I remember I collapsed. Yeah, I collapsed to the floor, and I rolled up in a ball, and then something indescribably wonderful happened, but trust me, it didn't feel godly or wonderful. It really felt awful. It felt painful. It felt nasty. It didn't feel godly. There were no butterflies and rainbows, but God split me wide open. and gave me a new perception, even for a brief moment. And this, I have found, must happen to someone like me. And it can happen while I'm sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because I might hit the wall in AA. I might flatline in AA. And I might need a new experience in AA, wondering, how come I can't? God's not tangible again. I'm reaching, but I can't grab anything. I'm just kind of going from meeting to meeting, going through the motions, but the fire has gone out, and we will bottom out. And what alcoholism will do is go underground and resurface in other areas. It happened to me during my first 6 months. Food spree, money spree, sex spree, fear spree, any kind of spree. Because just being here, present, way too painful. My mind's going 100 miles an hour. In fact, when my mind gets quiet for a brief moment, it says, enough of this. This is really uncomfortable. I need drama. I need gossip. I need to get into something. If I don't have drama, I'll ask you. You have drama. If you don't, let's invent drama. Just says do something. Just get into the into it. When I hit the floor, I remember beginning to weep. But like uncontrollably. Like a child weeping. And I couldn't stop the tears. And I said, oh my God, I must be losing my mind. We live life forward and understand that backwards, yeah? I didn't know what was going on with me. It was a bunch of years in Alcoholics Anonymous where it was crystal clear what was happening to me. It was a purging of years of betrayal, resentments and fears and addiction, embarrassment, guilt, remorse, all of it that we walk in here with. This is why just putting the plug in the jug, if you're able to do that, good luck. And just coming to meetings, what about all of that stuff? Because that's still there. And that's not curable by a human touch, only by the touch of the master's hand. Which means I need to have a relationship with this power in order to remold me like malleable clay and shape it different. And I have no say-so in that. The problem with someone like me is I'm so afraid of what I might become, I hold on to what I've been. I'd rather be ruined than changed very often. But here I was, and I'm weeping, and I can't stop weeping, and I'm thinking of my mom, I'm thinking about all these horrible things. And the very same God that I mocked and spat at for so long, I remember in this fear thinking, I need to get a drink of me now. But if I drink, I'm probably going to keel over and die. But if I don't get a drink of me, I'm going to keel over and die. I was at this jumping off place our book talks about. What do I do? And the very same God I hated, I called out to. And it was something like this, because I remember, if you're out there, please take me from this. I don't want to die. I was not thinking about Alcoholics Anonymous. Or going back to another treatment center, which would have been my seven, because I've been through seven treatment centers. Or doing that whole thing. And the idea, if you would have told me on June 23rd, 1988, you're going to go detox again, because the last time I went through treatment, the detox was horrific. I walked out. My first detox I did standing on my head a bunch of years later, they were painful. And the consequences are greater. Back then, I would pay any consequence tomorrow to feel comfort today. And eventually, it adds up. And then you're sitting in a detox going, it's not only the physical withdrawal I'm going through, but the head is in what I did again. My kids are not talking to me. My wife is leaving. I have no job. My relatives don't want to talk to me. I'm a bum. That's where I was. It was, please take me from this. I don't want to die. And then what happened to me, and I'm going to preface this by saying, if you haven't had a God experience, this is going to sound like Looney Tunes. If you have, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Because God's not interested in, well, I can speak to Joe when Joe has 10 years. God wants to get the broken kids when they're still using. See, I thought I had to do great things to achieve God's love. I thought if I change, I would experience God's love. But God's loving me so I can change all the time and have a direct encounter with this power. There's a great story I heard. A fella goes to his best friend and he says, listen, I want to change my life. Can you tell me all the terrible things I've done? I'm asking for forgiveness. And his friend pulls out like this big sheet of paper and says, just start listing all the terrible things he's done. Another fella goes to his creator and says, God, I want to change. I'll do anything. Can you tell me all the terrible sins I've committed? And God says, I don't remember. what I do because of my pride. I think I've sunk so low that this will never work or it is below me. So I'm in the back of this hallway. Please take me from this. I don't want to die. And what I got was this, and it was a whisper in this ear, this left ear. It went like this. Enough, I have other work for you to do. And I heard it clear, as if Sean came over and whispered something in my ear. Enough, I have other work for you to do. And I said, oh my God, this is what they talked about in treatment. You're going to hear voices, see things, wet brain. Yeah. I just bought the farm. This is serious stuff. I'm completely out of my mind. There is no one in this abandoned building. I'm in the back of the building. There is no one in there. There hasn't been anyone in there. It's just me and a pint of whiskey, and someone just spoke to me in my ear. Oh my God, I'm out of my mind. Here's the good news, guys. I was completely out of my mind. Only when I'm out of my mind can I hear that voice. It's when I'm in my mind, I hear a lot of other voices, but not the voice. I don't hear the truth. There are many truths in life. Got to pay taxes. You can't break the law because you'll go to jail. We're going to be born and we're going to die. We have to eat. We have to drink water and stay hydrated. There's certain truths we have to do. We need shelter, especially in this weather. You need to be somewhere where it's warm. These are truths. But there is one truth, the truth. And that's what I'm concerned with. And sometimes we're brought to that kind of truth through pain and misery. In order to get to the light, I need to walk through the darkness at some point. And then when I get to stand in the light, that light is nothing but darkness to the mind because the mind can't get that. The mind's trying to figure that out. Please take me from this. I don't want to die. And the voice went, enough. I have other work for you to do. And I didn't know what that meant until I was in here about 5 years, and I saw I was given a purposeful life, as that book says, purpose-driven life. I understood what my mission was here, stay sober and help God's kids, even when it's painful, even when it's an inconvenience, because somehow in the giving of all I got, I go home full. I get soul food in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't get mind, intellect, I get soul food. Knowledge received intellectually provides no nourishment for the soul. I can memorize the steps. I can memorize the concepts. I can memorize the traditions. I can quote the book, chapter, and verse, and be drunk an hour later. It's a transformation, not information I'm seeking. Enough, I have other work for you to do. And what happened in that moment of clarity, I remember thinking, I need to call my dad because the only guy on the entire planet who's going to come get me in this condition would be my dad, who I hadn't spoken to in quite a while. I remember going to a payphone. Newcomers, we had payphones on the street. You drop money in. We even had cassette tapes. Remember cassette tapes back in the day? I don't even know what an MP3 is. They said, you want an MP3? I thought they were cursing me out. I don't know what that means. And I went to call my dad, collect, and I couldn't make the call. My dad was in a town called Atlantic City, and he was spending some time there with his wife, gambling and watching the show and whoever was performing there. And as he told me at my first AA birthday, he got a feeling in his gut as he described it. That's that intuitive voice we all get. And I could look to push that voice away, that intuitive voice, that sixth sense, that inner resource. Christians call it the Holy Spirit. It's the same thing. We're all pointing towards the same thing. It's the godliness in us. And we can be a homeless bum and still have that voice. I don't need to be in AA 20 years to get the voice. What happens, I begin to hear the voice. My dad made his way back from Atlantic City. I had a feeling in his gut that I was in trouble, and he left the gambling table, as he told me, which was a tall order, and trekked his way back from Atlantic City, New Jersey, to New York, and he's driving through the streets, and he found me like a madman standing on the corner. I didn't know what I wanted to do. It was way too painful. I was way beyond needing a drink, and my dad got out of the car like where that wall is, and he stopped walking towards me, and he called my name, and I remember the very first thing I said to him, like a typical alcoholic. Now, I'm standing there with construction boots on. The right boot has no front, yeah? I got filthy, blood-stained, soiled pants on. It's June in New York, which means it's usually hot and kind of muggy. And I have this brown turtleneck, a black zip-up jacket. Yeah. And this is how I'm walking around. I haven't bathed, and I don't know, the last time I bathed or I had a meal, I was drinking, eating pills, and going down. Drinking, eating pills, and going down. That's how I was living. And so he sees me in this condition, and I tell him when he called my name, Dad, I'm fine, I'm okay. Yeah. And when he got in front of me, I collapsed. And when he was holding me up, now we hadn't been that intimate since I was probably a little guy, physically and emotionally intimate. And he was holding me up. There was nothing left. I didn't know our roots were about to grasp new soil, but he kept repeating something. I'm not going to lose my son to this over and over and over again. My dad could have got, God forbid, if I had some other terminal disease. He wouldn't like it, but people get these other things. He couldn't get, my kid is about to die from alcoholism. He couldn't make sense of that. And I got placed in my 7 treatment center. I like to tell you I was a golden child in treatment, but after 10 days in being in there, I'm thinking like, I got to get out of here. I need a drink again. The detoxes are horrific, and if I sit in one more group and talk about my enablers and my feelings, I'm going to kill somebody. You know, you're detoxing, they're asking you, how do you feel? I'm miserable. Leave me alone. I mean, you know. They call me into the office. He says, you got to get out of New York. It doesn't work here. People, places, and things kind of a situation. I thought people, places, and things was just treatment center mumbo jumbo. It's very real. I've done some studies on this. This is very real stuff, people, places, and things. The brain starts to fire differently when we're around people, places, and things. And so they sent me out to Minnesota, where I was supposed to go for just a few more weeks of treatment. I wound up living out there for a year. And I did treatment, halfway house, something called three-quarter house, something called sober house. And I was brought to a meeting called the Three Legacies meeting somewhere in Minneapolis. And my life changed again because I walked into a Friday night meeting with about 300 people there on a Friday night, all suited up. Everyone looked proper and spoke proper. And I was intimidated by it and at the same time attracted to it. And I would watch men come up to the podium and share openly and freely about God. They would weep freely from the podium and share gratitude and pain. I'm used to a different type of image of a man, idea of a man. I was grew up in a different environment, and this was actually refreshing to the soul. I wanted what you had to offer. I didn't know how to get there, but I was certainly made willing. What I've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is I don't trust willingness to me. Every morning when I pray, I still go to my God and ask him for the willingness to go to any lengths, because I'm not going to toss the dice on that one, because what if one day I'm not so willing? I'm alcoholic. I drink, regardless of how long I'm sober or how many times I get out to meetings. Alcoholism is alcoholism. I have alcoholism, not wasm. So I surrender that. I can easily get into control. We all have the right, this control, got to control an outcome. If I pray hard enough, I'm seeking control, because if I pray hard enough, God will give me the outcome I want, which means he really exists and really loves me, probably more than he loves you. And when God doesn't give me what I want, God is kind of like flimsy. He doesn't exist. And sometimes this control issue is rarely willfully relinquished, but usually involuntarily shattered through circumstances. When we hit the wall, I have no control anymore. I can't do anything about this. There's something in Scripture that says, knock and the door will open. It doesn't say knock and open the door. It says knock and the door will open. I'm supposed to do all the work I can and get to the door and knock and then wait. I'm an alcoholic. I kick it open. And it's always the wrong door. And God says, that's why I told you to wait. Pardon me. And my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guess we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow, has been challenging. It has been euphoric. It has been frightening. It has been change. if I always do what I always did, I'm always going to get what I always got. It's about changing and changing and changing. I was one of those guys who would go through the steps once and live in 10, 11, and 12, and that's what you do, and your joy is happy and free. I'm not here to change you. I did that for about 8 years or so, and I hit that spiritual wall. I'm writing them in turn, I'm working with others, I'm praying, I'm meditating, I just can't get traction. And I approached a gentleman from Texas, and I told him what was going on, and my sponsor's going off the deep end, and we began the journey through the steps again. I thought it was like blasphemy. You don't go through the steps more than once. And he says, how much experience you have going through the steps more than once? I says, no. He says, then just you have contemporary navigation. Shut up and follow directions. And I remember this incredible experience I had in revisiting the 4 through 9, bringing death to self-will, and 10, 11, 12, bringing life to the spirit. New perceptions, new ideas, new emotions, and a better relationship with God, a more awake relationship with God, because he's always talking, but I'm not listening. And if I'm not clear, I can't hear. My story began at like 14 years old. I grew up in, I would never say dysfunctional family, because they're not here to defend themselves. All I know is I was the alcoholic. My mom was alcoholic. She had some psych issues. She was addicted to Valium, and we would take her in and out of psych wards regularly, and she tried suicide a handful of times, and then she finally succeeded in 1974. And about maybe 4, 5, 6 months later, I took my first drunk on. That wasn't the plan. Back in Brooklyn, New York, that's where I'm from originally, in the 70s, what you did was hung out on street corners. That's what we did. You turn the music on as loud as you can until disco ruined everything, and then we were. I don't know what happened back then. I blame MTV for the world's problems anyway, but but we used to listen to rock and roll and hang out on a street corner and drink beer. That's what the older guys would do, yeah? And this one spring summer night, I grabbed a quart of beer, Colt 45 beer, and I took a few pops off the beer. I didn't know where I was going. I just saw the other guys seemed to be having a good time. They were listening to the music. Everyone turns into a gangster in Brooklyn. That's the goal, to be a gangster. To be wanted by the FBI is an achievement where I come from. It's like, well, he's wanted by the FBI. He's really made his mark in this world. I'm so proud of him. Yeah, it's insane how the thinking is back then. I drank and got drunk, and I remember it was like the older guys. I can talk to the girls. I was so shy. You know, I'd see a pretty girl, and you know, I just get all tongue tied. I didn't know. I'd walk away, you know, and obsess on her for like 6 months. Then I got sober and learned how to stalk. That's what we do in LA, stalk. That's how Alcoholics Anonymous spell loves, stalking. I see the new guys, right? Mary's at a meeting and Joe just happens to show up and watches every. Yeah. This is love. And when I got drunk that night, the pain of losing my mom and this terrible fear I had of my dad, I was really intimidated by him. He's an alpha male, real tough guy from an area called South Brooklyn. If anyone's seen Goodfellas, I mean, that's like my dad. A tough, tough guy. Not that he was a poor father or wouldn't give time to his children, but it wasn't warm and fuzzy. And there's no such thing as crying in the house. You just know you're a man. You don't cry. And I was very intimidated by him because he seemed to be always right. And I seemed to be always wrong. And he had a way of operating. He still does. God bless him at 83. Eyeball to eyeball when he speaks to you. And he'll follow your eyes, because if you're looking the other way, that means you're lying. I was always lying. So it's tough to be around this type of guy. And so when I got drunk that night, a lot of that went away. It just kind of went away, and I felt freer than I ever had. Bill says it best in his story, I had arrived. I arrived. I love the effect produced by alcohol. I love the effect produced by God now, because God, what alcohol did was turn his flight like a boomerang. Our big book talks about that. I couldn't see what was about to happen to me. And my life was about feeding the ego, and who even knows about a spirit? And I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's about feeding spirit and starving the ego. How free do I want to be? It's a question we ask ourselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. How free do I want to be? When I was getting drunk, I always wanted to get drunker. I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, it's like, enough God, I'm driving tonight. I mean, it makes no sense. This meeting has too much God. I've seen these things. It's too religious. It's too godly. They talk too much about God in AA. Well, what else are we supposed to talk about in Alcoholics Anonymous? The steps, the big book, the fellowship, all of it is a vehicle to get right with God. And you show me a drunk who's locked in with God, and I will show you a sober alcoholic. Not only sober, but has some sort of traction in here, has soul life going on. Because if I'm an alcoholic and I'm living from the head, I'm in serious trouble, and I will hurt you. I will lie to you. I will betray you because it's all about me. I look at life as it pertains to me. It's always about me. But when I live from the soul knows where to go, what to do, what to say, and how to be. It's the longest distance in the world from here to here. But I love the effect produced by Colt 45 beer. And I was roughhousing and talking to the girls, and the music got better. My friends became great. The girls got prettier. This was a wonderful night. But I remember, you can't end this. Because at a certain hour, guys start to head home. But no, don't. See, I thought it would last forever. I wanted it to last forever. I found a panacea for my ills, yeah? A panacea that was going to that finally worked. The mom pain, the dad pain, the pain of just being me in this suitcase that I walk around with. I was never good enough, not smart enough, not good looking enough. I just, not tough enough, just whatever I did. I was a very, very gifted musician growing up. You know? I was like 8 years old and playing jazz music and like percussion instruments and piano. And my family wanted to send me to, I think it was called Juilliard. And I would get these great accolades from people, from teachers and things like that. And if they gave me a standing ovation, I would say thank you, get really uncomfortable, and then 5 minutes later say, yeah, but I'm not that good. Clancy says something like, well, people have to be treated extra special just to feel normal. And it's short-lived. And because I'm sober and Alcoholics Anonymous, that guy is still with me. You know, we all have that, the guys have that other guy, the ladies have that other lady, that shadow that follows us around. It's always talking and whispering. You better not, you should. Rather than the spirit who's telling us exactly what to do all the time. I listen to the head, not the spirit. And I went home that night, there were no consequences of my using. Getting drunk. I got up the next day to go play ball on the street. It was a great thing. Yeah. Went to the park, played basketball, had a war story from the night before. But I remember that I captured, as Bill said, this elusive feeling for the first time. I found something that worked and I wanted more. I knew nothing about obsession and craving. I'm an alcoholic. The craving's intensified when I drink. I don't know what your story is, but I have a first drink, and it'll call me. Regardless of the consequences you put in front of me of how bad things are about to get if I get drunk, I get drunk because I cannot stop it. I can't outthink it. That's called self-reliance and willpower. A moderate and a hard drinker says, I used to be an alcoholic, came to AA, and I don't drink anymore. I don't do any steps. I just go to meetings. Bless their hearts. They're not like me. I'm a real alcoholic. I could say, I'm not going to drink no matter what because I'm going to go to jail. She's going to leave. Health problems, give me a double. I'll only have one. But I'm also alcoholic, which means I have to have a second drink. Do you ever notice like the third drink screams louder than the first and second? Once it's on us, and then you get to a point where I'll figure it out tomorrow. I really don't care. And that's what happened to me towards the end. I didn't even care anymore. I just wish I'd, you know, roll over and die. Who am I kidding? I used to come to AA, usually stand in the back and drunk, raise my hand and share and critique the speaker. H and I would come into the treatment center. It sounded, you know, looking at the beauty of a spiritual awakening in someone, looking at the beauty of someone being transformed right in front of your eyes, can coexist with the reluctance to do what they did to get where they are. And so I would see these folks, you know, H&I folks telling their story, and they were successful, head up and shoulder square. And I says, it looks good, but you're also Peter Marinelli, which means nothing good's going to happen to you. So stop the charade already. Just stop it. That's what my head would tell me. It wants no part of recovery. And again, because I'm sober, it doesn't mean that that other guy has gone away. He's just gone dormant. He'll wake up at any moment. Because I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and have a sponsor and do the steps, that voice just goes dormant. That guy goes dormant. Doesn't mean I'm cured of this thing. Because given enough ammunition, that wakes up. The lion on the back on our back wakes up, and we're wondering, how did my life get here? I was just sober, and now I'm in a detox. I'm married, and I'm chasing women. I've talked about rigorous honesty. I'm embezzling from my boss, or I just don't show up anymore. And what I did was I was drinking on the weekends, and it rolled into more progression. Progression does what progression does. And I'm drinking fairly regularly and getting caught a lot. And at the beginning of my drinking, I wasn't very pleasant. I had a first few drunks were very euphoric, and then it got nasty because I would think about this terrible God who took my mom. I'm stuck with this guy called Dad who knows nothing about sports. He knows nothing about music. He looked at that thing as like kind of sissy activities. And so we always clashed. And I became vengeful and hateful, and all this venom would come out when I would drink. And like a good alcoholic, I'd like to have money, but I don't want to work for it, so I steal. And I start to steal from my family. One morning, I discovered my dad's checkbook. And I had this great idea. If I just fill out the check and sign his name, I can go down to the local store. The we call them bodegas in New York, like a delicatessen. I don't know if you have them out here, but like they all knew my dad. They knew who he was. And they didn't want any kind of grief from him. So I'd walk in and says, hey, my dad said he had no cash. He gave me this check to cash for me. Can you do that? They knew what I was doing, but they didn't want to say no. They didn't want to deal with my old man, so they give me like $20 here. I did it again, and I did it again. I thought I hit Powerball or something, and this is a great thing. I knew nothing about checking statements, that these things come back in the mail when you write a check. I thought you write a check, it gets cash, and it disappears. One day I called the house. I was out and about, and my brother answered. He said, what did you do now? The old man's looking for you. And I was like, what's his problem? He's got plenty of money. See, I was an alcoholic. I look at things as they pertain to me. You know, when I go make amends in step 9, it's way more than I'm sorry. When I say I'm sorry, I'm just usually looking for you to let me off the hook. And if I go to make amends and I took $20 off you and I give you 20 plus interest, well, that squares the note. But it doesn't talk about the internal harm I caused on one of my best friends or a family member. It isn't about the money. It's you're a family member or my buddy or a wife or a husband, and you've broken my heart. You've violated me. The money, yeah, was squared on the note, but what about the pain? I didn't understand that. It wasn't the money that my dad was obviously concerned I was stealing from him, but why is my son stealing from me? Why don't he just ask me, as he's told me many times over the years, just come and ask me. And I got caught, and I went to my first treatment. So I'll tell you how I got caught. My dad got all these checks back in the mail, and I was sitting in Lower Manhattan. I was sitting in the car with this young lady I met the night before. So you know alcoholics. I'm in love now. I'm planning the names of my children. I weigh, 110 pounds soaking wet, and I'm sitting in the car. Now, how you drive in Brooklyn is, they probably do it out here, is you got to have a big Cadillac. You know, we call them Dadillacs because it's your dad's car, but you don't tell her. And you roll the seat all the way back. You roll down the windows. The music goes as loud as it can. Your shirt gets open down to here. I got the Walmart pinky ring going on and the fake jewelry, and I'm sitting in the car, and I'm looking at her, and she's looking at me, and I'm looking at her, and she's looking at me, and I'm thinking like it was a cross between like Dirty Harry and Snoop Dogg. I mean, this was a great thing. And then the old man rolled up right across the street. And he got out of the car, and he screamed my name. And I handle it like any player wood. Any tough guy, any man's man, wood. And what I told her was, that's my dad. I'm getting out of here. You speak to him. And I ran away. Yeah, that's exactly what I did. And my dad caught me. And the very first thing I did was blame this woman sitting in my car. She was a bad influence. And then I blamed the neighborhood. And then I pulled out the trump card. Mom committed suicide. I don't know what I'm doing anymore. I'm lost. And so my dad says, I understand, so I'm going to put you in something called a treatment center. I didn't even know what these things were. And I went to my first treatment center for 28 days, and we did a lot of groups. I also fell in love about six times while I was in there, which I found out was rehab romance. I was in love every other day. I would do push-ups and sit-ups in my room. I go to group talk about my feelings and my issues and my triggers and my enablers. As soon as they said medication time, I snapped to attention, got my meds, and zoned out. That was treatment for me. 28 days later, I got out and got drunk. Listen, over a bunch of years, my first six treatment centers, I managed on my own power 2 days of continuous sobriety. I was the guy that would walk out and get drunk or get drunk within an hour. That's been my track record. I could not deal with sobriety. Listen, I don't like sobriety. I don't know how I would stay sober, just dry, this long. It's like asking us or me to hold my breath for 31 years without any kind of spiritual muscles. Sobriety is painful. It's uncomfortable. I don't have a GPS to navigate through life. I don't get, and I'll speak for myself, while we tell newcomers, do life on life's terms. When did this happen? Life on life's terms, a double vodka to get out of bed and more of everything. I'm fear-based, insecure, the ego, the size of this room. That's me doing life on life's terms. I'm never satisfied. I'm always dissatisfied. I never arrive. I'm always striving. I can't achieve anything. I'm always restless, irritable, and discontented. And I have chatter of a thousand voices all at once. That's me on life's terms. And at some point, I need a double vodka to shut it all down. Life on God's terms is different. Did you ever wake up first thing in the morning in the middle of an argument as soon as you open your eyes? We're a little slow on this side. No, you wake up like 6 o'clock in the morning, your eyes open, and you're going, I'll get that son. And you're right in the middle of it. I can't tell you how many times I sat down to have my first cup of coffee. And the older I get, this is very important, the first cup of coffee. Yes. Don't interfere with it, right? I need to get a pulse nowadays from a cup of coffee. But having the first cup of coffee, so after prayer and meditation and my readings in the morning, I make a pot of coffee. I usually get online and I like to look at a ESPN and what's going on in the world and a little bit of this and a little bit of that, social media and stuff. I'm having my first cup of coffee, and I think I'm sitting at the table, me, Peter Marinelli, having a cup of coffee, but I'm in for a rude awakening because there's about five other guys sitting there. I got Moses, the AA guru, live and let live, and I got Rambo, kill them. I got the entrepreneur guy. I got the relationship guy. I got the Romeo guy. It's interesting when Rambo speaks to Moses, by the way. This is an interesting conversation. And they're all sitting there, and every one of them has an agenda. And we listen to all of them. And we entertain everything they say. So we walk out the door at 7 o'clock in the morning and go to work after a good night's sleep. We're already exhausted. And you call your sponsors going, I don't know, I'm all confused. Well, I'm listening to 14 people before I even get out the door. And I believe every one of those voices to be valid voices. The reason why the voices in the head are so powerful, because I believe them all to be true. Everything that comes from me, it must be true. And yet when it comes from the soul, comes from the spirit, it can't be true. I treat my mind like God and God like my mind. I made my second, third, and fourth, and fifth treatment center. And after my fifth treatment center, I remember I was up there for 9 weeks in this facility. And back in the day, it was a 28-day model. That's when the insurance company said, you're cured, you're out. 28 days, detox, boom, out. And that's what they would do, 28 days and ship you off. And when I was in my fifth treatment center, I remember the clinician say, we need to hold on to you longer. And whatever they did, they held on to me longer. And they kept me in this facility for 9 weeks. And after 9 weeks of being in a facility, this lockdown unit, this little cocoon, I look relatively healthy because I'm eating and sleeping. Yeah, I'm exercising. There's color back in my face. I'm past post-acute withdrawal stuff. And then they tell me, this coming Saturday, you're going to be discharged. I think I'm good to go. I know what I need to do. Yeah, we all said that. In fact, I haven't even been thinking about drinking. That's where I learned it's always thinking about me. And I walked out the door on a Saturday morning in Amityville, Long Island, and I was slammed with me. The biggest enemy in the world. The carpenter said, love your enemies. When I heard that, I started scanning the room. Who's the enemy? Until I was shaving one day and I had this epiphany. There he is. It's me. I despise this. The head woke up. The anxiety came back. The nervousness, all of it. And on Saturday and Sunday, I remember being home with my dad and both my brothers, and I was tossing and turning all night. I couldn't sleep. The anxiety in my chest, it felt like it was going to explode. I had no appetite. I couldn't even carry on a conversation with someone because my head woke up with all the voices, and one of the voices would say, just get a drink, just one drink, just take the edge off. A bump, a toke, a pill, just something, take the edge off, because after all, you just did 9 weeks. You should have a little something and then go to Alcoholics Anonymous. But you need something to take the edge off. When I walked out of treatment, I realized how fast the world is moving. When I'm in treatment, it's nice and slow motion. How are you feeling today? No one cares when you're out there. And it was just way too fast. And my default button is I know how to do life on life's terms. I drink. And I'll figure it out. And I held on Saturday and I held on Sunday. And my thing has been this for a long time. That we have to, I'll speak for myself. I have to meet my demons at some point. Face to face. And after this fifth treatment center, on a Monday morning, white knuckling for 2 days, I get in my car and I drive all the way to South Brooklyn to a liquor store because I need to drink. I'm not thinking about AA and the consequences. I just need to drink because my body doesn't feel good. My head definitely doesn't feel good. There's nothing wrong with my body, by the way. And I get to the liquor store and he's closed. It's too early in the morning. And I got out of my car. Guys, I'm pacing back and forth. Now, I want to reiterate, there's nothing wrong with my body. It was as sober as it was ever going to be. But the head was another story. This failed system, the thing that doesn't work, the head. It's telling me you need a drink, you need a drink, you need a drink, you need a drink, to the point where I felt like my body was going through withdrawal again. My hands are shaking, my belly's upset, my forehead is sweaty. There's nothing wrong with me, but the head has another story. And when he opened the doors, I went in there, bought a pint of whiskey, I ran back out and drank it. As fast as I could, because I'm thinking I really need a drink. And I finished the pint. Now, a non-alcoholic would probably feel that, get in the car and drive home. But I'm alcoholic. I had to go back in and get a second pint. And by the time I finished the second pint, I was drunk. And when I'm drunk, I like to get drunker and buy pills. I didn't see that drunk coming when I was sitting in treatment. I couldn't see it coming. And for youngins who are in here, and maybe you got 30 days and 60 days and 90 days and everyone's applauding for you and saying you look good, you sound good, you're doing great. Don't pay too much attention to that. Pay more attention to God, because we can fall in love with, look at me, I'm the new star of home group, and forget about the first half of the first step that says, Joe, you're drinking, I don't care what you acquire. That's been my story. I like nice things, I'm not going to lie. I like living in comfort, I'm not going to lie. But I can get into delusional thinking that as long as I acquire nice, comfortable things, that I'm somehow really sober. And sobriety has nothing to do with that. Sobriety for me hinges on my relationship with this power called God and nothing less than that. Great fact, that's been my experience. If you have a different experience, God bless you, but it's not mine. Guys, I'm not a model nor am I an example. I'm just here to share with you my story, huh? And I got drunk, As the big book says, thus started one more journey to the asylum for Jim. It happened for me. My dad got me an apartment, and I got thrown out of there in a short time. And I was living on the streets. I made a day and a half in my sixth treatment center and walked out. I wasn't dealing with this anymore. I just want to drink and die. I realized that's what I wanted. Eat enough pills or whatever it was. And I laid off the narcotics, other than the pills and drink, and that I couldn't get away from. I wound up outside the Port Authority in Midtown Manhattan. I had this moment of clarity, what I had turned into. I think God gives us all that moment of clarity in those depths of despair. And what I did with that was spit back at God. It was a few months later, June 23rd, 1988, showed up. And what I have found, June 23rd, 1988, I'm physically weak, emotionally weak. And I have been afraid in recovery. I have been skeptical and doubtful about God. I have been lost my way a few times after my divorce. I felt like less than a man because I couldn't keep a woman. My ex-wife was alcoholic. I'm an AA member. I'm a man. I should keep my woman and keep her sober. And I felt like I lost and I was less than, and I had lost my way. And I've been afraid many, many times. And what I'm happy to report to you, it's in our moments of great trials and tribulations in weakness, when we feel weak and vulnerable, it's when I tap into God's greatest strength. It's when I think I got it all together and I really have arrived in Alcoholics Anonymous, I leave no room for God because I'm running the show. Self-reliance has shown up. And the longer I'm sober, I watch how slippery self-reliance is. I'm going to take care of it. Well, how about God? I need to figure this out. My sponsors, did you pray about this yet? It's slippery. It bores a hole right into what I'm doing. And once it bores one hole, it bores another, and suddenly I'm totally in self-reliance. Yeah. And self-reliance brings about God's not going to fix it, so I have some current agnosticism, which means I have some fear going on, which now means part of my life is completely unmanageable, but I walk into a meeting and Sean says, how you doing? Good. Everything's good. I'm great. Great. Just, God damn it, I'm great. So, you know. And then I get back in my car, and I'm not great. I got this charade going on. In my greatest weakness, I find this power. I find his strength. I remember being outside this restaurant many years ago, right after my divorce. She got the house, the car, moved her boyfriend into my house, just the bank account. I'm left basically with zero. And my friends took me out to dinner, and I was so beaten up. Like, you know when you're just so depressed you can't eat? You know, I was just so afraid. I was embarrassed to walk and say it because I thought everyone's going to say, Pete Marinelli's a failure because he got divorced, couldn't keep his wife. Yeah, that's how I was feeling. And they took me out to dinner. I couldn't eat. I went into the parking lot, and it was evening. And I looked up to the heavens. I says, listen, I'm done running my life again. Well, I thought having the wife, you know, the house with the white picket fence, a couple of cars, nice little bank account, I had arrived. And I lost sight of you in that. Because I can come in on the bottom and go out on top. Things I get in AA should never block me from God. But that's what little by slowly was happening. God will remove things. His way of giving to me, his way of loving me is by removing things. And I said, I'm sick. I'm done running the show. I'll do anything you tell me to do. And I call my sponsor, Mark, and he says, sounds like we need to go through the steps again. That's not the answer I wanted, but that's what we did. I needed a new relationship and a new attitude. The step five talks about with this God. So maybe tomorrow we'll get to share about some of the experiences and the life-changing events that God has fed me with. Because over and over and over again, it's kind of like God is just revealing himself to us to say, I'm with you. I got you. It's not on your terms, it's on my terms. I can see down the road you can't. And I'm thinking, God's this benevolent father who's just going to give me. And God said, like, if we have children, you can't give them everything you want, they want. But God sees down the road, he sees trouble up ahead, so he'll pull me back and he'll remove things. But it's always like, I got you, I'm with you, and I'll send in the AA troops. to keep you safe and protected in this place, the sacred rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you haven't found out AA is sacred, I pray you stick around long enough to experience the sacredness of AA, where we see lives get reborn and resurrected right in here, for fun and for free. And for that I owe, yeah? That's all I got. Peace.